Good afternoon. I'm Adam Ragusea, and it's time for You to Ask the Mayor. Bloomington Mayor Mark Cruzan is here in the studio with us to answer questions about city issues of concern to you. The phone numbers to call to speak with Mayor Cruzan are toll-free 877-285-9348. And a local call here in Bloomington is 855-0811. If you prefer, you can send an email to mayor@indiana.edu. We do check that address throughout the show, and one listener has already taken the advantage of sending in an email. Once again, the phone numbers to call are 877-285-9348 and 855-0811. The email is mayor@indiana.edu. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor.
Greetings, Adam. And I have a trivia question for you.
Sure.
I'm gonna put you on the spot. What is the theme music?
The theme music is the third movement to Steve Reich's Electric Counterpoint.
You know, I thought I was going to stump you. I'm proud of you, and I'm embarrassed I didn't know myself, of course. That's
well,
great.
It's a kind of a
4 years it took me to ask that question.
Well, it's a bit of a secret around here that my past is in the School of Music.
That is impressive.
All right. Beautiful day in Bloomington. Autumn seems to be here sort of finally, kind of, maybe.
Sort of, kind of, maybe. It's a transitional time of year, obviously, seasonally, but also within government, and you can see that just in. I'm going to do a quick community calendar thing.
Sure.
Real quickly here. Just in our parks and recreation offerings, the farmers market hours have changed from 9 to 1. It'll be an apple tasting this Saturday. The following Saturday, a soup tasting, another seasonal thing. Trick-or-treat trail is at Olcott Park from noon till 4 on Saturday, October 27th. If you'll indulge me, Skate and Scare is at Frank Southern on October 27th. There's a festival of ghost stories on Friday, October 26th. And my personal favorite, the Great Bloomington Pumpkin Launch, is November 3rd. And you can just go to the city website and bloomington.in.gov, look for Parks and Recreation, or call 349-3700 to get details on all of those.
All right. We hope to see everybody out there. To go from stuff that's very much fun to stuff that's decidedly not fun,
right.
Let's talk a little bit about this incident that occurred yesterday
sure.
morning, an incident of shots fired. And if you'll indulge me, I just want to
sure.
remind our listeners of the basic timeline of events that occurred yesterday. Around 7:02, some 911 calls revealed that what happens is the 27-year-old Jesse Sneed, apparently drunk, starts firing rounds from a high-powered, long-range, semiotic weapons that would have been illegal up until 2004 under the federal assault weapons ban. Around 8:25, the suspect is arrested, and according to the police report, he made an unsolicited statement indicating that he was the person behind the shots being fired. But despite that, police remained very cautious. The area remains cordoned off for about 3 more hours. 5 nearby schools remain in code yellow status, which is just essentially a lockdown involving free movement on the inside. And around 11:15, the police issue an all clear. How does an event like this unfold from the standpoint of the mayor's office?
Well, and again, I mean, it really ultimately is a blessing that nothing more happened. Mm. While it's certainly not a city issue, at the state legislative level, when I served for 16 years in the legislature, pretty consistently voted to restrict the kind of ownership of assault weapons that, it's just beyond my comprehension as to why we allow people to own them when there's no legitimate use in terms of hunting. And I know there are others who disagree with that perspective, but I bemoan the expiration of the assault weapon ban. And it's not obviously what leads to something like this happening. Mm-hmm. I understand, but it certainly gives opportunity that might not otherwise have occurred. In terms of the city's perspective, this is what our police department, but certainly the front and center is the police department has trained for, and I think that training just shows for those of us in the administrative part of city government, it's really a situation of monitoring and literally staying out of the way. It's if you get to a point where this had spread, if there have been other suspects, if it turns into something beyond the kind of quote unquote isolated event, then there are provisions for bringing together a countywide emergency response, and that ultimately is coordinated under the office of the mayor and then the county commissioners. We didn't have to get to that level, but I don't think I can overstate the pride I have in the way the police responded in terms of the time, the overwhelming nature of the response, the professionalism, and the coordination. And that coordination was key to me. And just reviewing the reports and looking at and thanking, by the way, IUPD, the Monroe County Sheriff, the state police, as well as, and this may not have struck people as something that was necessary, but as well as our firefighters who have to show up with apparatus and equip the police with ladders and other what can turn out to be life-saving tools in order to support the police response. You've got the ambulance crews. You've got an awful lot that goes into it, and I think it was the communication between the departments and within the departments was incredible. I think the communication to the public was very good, and we thank the media and obviously the cable override system. But the one other group that sometimes doesn't get noted in responses like this is the is central dispatch, those 911 communicators who handle the calls, relay information to the police, keep the callers calm, and in this case, keeping the callers safe. And if you have an opportunity, you can go to the Herald Times website and listen to some of the 911 calls that came in and pay particular attention to how the dispatchers respond. It's an amazing team that worked together yesterday, and I think took a very cautious approach, even though I think they knew almost immediately when they got there and they apprehended a suspect that it was probably over. But they obviously went with the cautious approach in ensuring their own safety, which is first because you have to be able to protect the public by protecting yourself. And I just feel like it went as seamlessly as it could go.
I was down at the scene yesterday morning, and it was very calm at the scene. People were moving very slowly. It was very low key, but the mood in a lot of places around the community was anything but. Mm-hmm. And in examining the data record of yesterday, whether it's police reports, news reports, message boards online, a lot of misinformation got got thrown around in the morning. The notions that there was a hostage situation, all kinds of stuff that ultimately proved to be false, to the point where a classroom in IUPUI was under lockdown for a time. And I wonder if maybe the public information climate is different now, such that with everyone with computers and mobile devices really expect to get constant updates about everything, such that the media tend to be overeager in bringing new information to air, because it's rather than utilizing their editorial judgment and restraint and really vetting things before bringing it to the public. And that's part of why our response to it here at the station was really very conservative in the morning. And I wonder if maybe that new climate really does necessitate perhaps a stronger executive presence, both from city government and from the police, in terms of really assuring the public that there's not a shooter on campus, that the event is contained to where it is. That makes sense to you at all?
Well, the expectation is certainly different in terms of news. I think maybe some of the executive decisions have to be made on the part of executives and media, and I do appreciate the fact that your station took that cautious approach and you make sure that what you're reporting is fact. Some of it's not even done, though, through news, and it's now done through text messages. It's absolutely instantaneous. And I just was down at the Herald Times this morning and talking to the administrative assistant at the front desk, who said there were people calling in from different parts of the country to ask because their kids would hear about it, call their parents. Their parents were concerned about the welfare of their kids. They call into the newspaper. And I'm sure we're calling the police department. And I know there are some 911 calls of people calling to ask, were they okay? The immediate need is the site itself, and that is to me what was most important. And the fact that there was there wasn't any kind of a panic situation, and I think some people I've heard yesterday, well, why is it that it's 2 or 3 hours later and we don't know yet whether or not there's someone else in there? And that is very intentionally done by the police, is not to show up and just burst in kind of the guns blazing. It is to set up that perimeter, make sure that everyone in the immediate area is evacuated, kept safe, and then to methodically go through and search the area. In terms of what happens outside, I think there's some of it's human nature and some of it is common sense, that when you're suddenly shutting down buildings at IUPUI, I'm not sure there's any amount of communication coming from the government or police that are going to prevent that in the climate in which we now live, that they're it stems from school shootings. It stems from the availability of weapons, the change in society. And part of that change is the 24-hour media coverage that we have now. Aside from media, just our ability to communicate with one another literally, globally, instantaneously is going to put out bad information. Our effort, and it's very centralized, it's kept centralized so that there aren't multiple sources giving conflicting information, is through the police department as they feel it's responsible to relay the information. And even that certainly won't be perfect. And to some degree, they weren't sure what exactly was happening. The suspect that was apprehended was not being cooperative. There were stories and both from witnesses and from the witnesses themselves on the scene who literally thought they saw a second person there. And if there's not a person in the apartment or in the complex, does that mean that someone has driven away? Is there a threat outside that area? There were unanswered questions at the time, and I think the updates that were given were as responsible as they could be. And in hindsight, you can always think, well, now that we know this wasn't a threat, why wasn't that stated at the time? But I'm not sure you can combat, Adam, everything that comes out in terms of bad information that ends up with buildings in some other city shutting down.
Yeah, and indeed, people are always going to be a little bit annoyed with the police for being overcautious until that one time when they're not.
And there were people who even yesterday were not happy, were going up to the police officers who were stopping traffic and asking they live in there. They need to get in there. That's where they belong, or they work there. They're late for work. And obviously, it's a time where even if it turned out there was nothing at all that had happened and that the police were being, again, quote unquote, overly cautious, which was not the case. But if it had been the case, I would never fault the officers from stopping someone. And I would ask for obviously all of us to cooperate in cases like that where we don't know what's happening. And that's why we pay the salaries of people who are out to determine what that is. The other thing I would note on the question that you asked, which was a good one, is that after something like this, there's also review. There will be review of the response, individual officer's response. The dispatchers will look at how calls were handled, and will also look at public communication, and certainly welcome comment from any media outlet or public in terms of ways in which it can be improved.
Well, speaking of public comment, we've got a caller on the line. Joe is online. Joe, are you there?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Hi.
With the mayor.
Okay, thanks. Just to change the topic a little bit,
okay.
To think you explored that one really, really well. Just had a question for the mayor on the BEAD program.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've got the color-coded maps and everything, and the mayor's hired somebody to run the program, but I wondered, are there going to be any direct benefits to artists and the gallery owners? I think the city recognizes how important the arts are in the community, but a lot of the money doesn't seem to trickle to the galleries and the artists who create the work. Like, are there going to be rent abatements or utility breaks or tax, what do they call those, tax incentives?
Yes.
Like they give to residents? Are you going to help fund lofts where artists want to live? And I just wondered if there's going to be direct benefits to artists and the galleries.
Great question, Joe.
It is a great question, and I think that we look at this as kind of a threefold, is the direct artist support, trying to encourage the patronage of the arts, which will also directly benefit artists, and then simply the kind of general community character for even those who might not have an interest in arts but that will end up benefiting from this kind of economic development. And yes, there will be – I think you mentioned one, and I missed it, but I'll have to review in my memory. You mentioned one item that I'm not sure that we have considered. Oh, you said utility abatements, and I'm not sure that has been considered, and that's something certainly we will look at. There are different laws that affect ratepayers and taxpayers that we might have to consider, but that certainly is something I'd like to include. We're looking at other communities and how it's being handled elsewhere in terms of and you mentioned loft space or artist space. There is a developer in town who's interested in teaming up with the city to work on a project just like that. I'd like to see some artist space that could also be viewed by the public, that we could see artists at work as part of the cultural amenities that we can offer to the city, to city residents and to visitors. The BEAD, for those who might not know, is the Bloomington Entertainment and Arts District. We've been having strategic planning meetings. There's another one on Monday, November 5th. So Joe and others are certainly welcome to participate in that and make sure that this is something we have heard many times and from the Bloomington Area Arts Council, the commission. I know that they're interested in trying to promote not just support of the arts and patronage of the arts, but also artists themselves. I view them as business people in the community as well as artists and adding to the local economic vitality. The final plan is to be completed by December 3rd, and all the input that Joe and others are giving us will be put into that final plan.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Joe. I want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Bloomington Mayor Mark Cruzan here on Ask the Mayor. Phone numbers are 877-285-9348. And 855-0811, or send an email to mayor@indiana.edu. We have just over 10 minutes of the mayor's time left this afternoon, and we have Steve on the line. Steve, are you with us?
Hi. Greetings, Mr. Mayor.
Hi there.
Because of my concerns about environmental sustainability, I've been studying the issue of urban sprawl and its harmful effects, and I've been noticing some recent developments here in Bloomington contributing to sprawl. And I'm calling today about a plan that I and many other citizens are opposed to. It's a plan by NDOT, that's the Indiana Department of Transportation, to widen the section of East 10th Street that's a part of State Road 45. And I was at a meeting at City Hall with NDOT officials on September 26th. And the reason given for this project was that many years ago, NDOT predicted that traffic on the road would increase, but information presented at this meeting showed that automobile traffic has actually been decreasing for several years, while walking, bicycling, and bus riding have increased. And the logical conclusion is that the road does not need to be widened now. And I was astounded to hear the NDOT officials say, in essence, well, too bad. It's already been planned, and it's too late to make any changes now. And I could hardly believe that. So my question to you is, are you aware of what transpired at that meeting, and will you vigorously oppose this wasteful and detrimental plan?
Well, and we have opposed the way in which they're approaching it, and we've had quite a few communications with NDOT as well as with our state legislative delegation. State Senator Vi Simpson, State Representative Matt Pierce, State Representative Peggy Welch have all contacted NDOT as well. And I have to say that the response that they're getting as well is very similar to the one that you describe in that meeting. It's the same meeting, the same response that we've gotten as our planners and through my office. It is a concern in terms of – it's not so much that it shouldn't be done. It's how it's being done. And I actually support having it be improved, but improvements don't simply mean widening. Improvements include widening, but also would feature much better bike pedestrian ways that I think, as you point out, there has certainly been an increase in bicycle pedestrian traffic on that route. The other concern we have is a different kind of vehicle, and that's our transit buses. Transit is also not – Bloomington Transit is also not happy with the NDOT plan and has been trying to communicate with the state on the issue. There are really no accommodations being made for encouraging mass transit use, that the in terms of bus stops, in terms of moving buses through traffic, having separate lanes. There is a certain irony to the state's argument that this has been on the books so long, because I would agree with them. It has. It's been on the books for, I believe, as long as 20 years. And I think the plan shows that. It shows that it's antiquated in that it was being planned at a time when I think that the proposal is outmoded. And right now there are we're in an era where we do want to promote bicycle-pedestrian flow, and we want to promote mass transit. And that's what we're going to – yes, we are going to continue to vigorously address it. It is a state project, even though people look at it as being 10th Street. And obviously it feels like a city street. It is controlled as part of the state highway system. So they ultimately do have the decision-making authority, and they view it as a part of the bypass improvement as well, which it clearly is. But I don't believe it's ever too late to relook at a plan.
Steve, is there anything else you'd like to bring up on this?
Yeah. I agree. We should take into account this new information. I'm just afraid that the bureaucratic momentum of the Department of Transportation is, going to push this through no matter what. And I hope that the city and IU can work together to, come up with a better plan, way to do this.
And that's a good point. I should have mentioned that IU is that's absolutely right. And IU is also concerned in terms of – because so much of that population is IU population trying to traverse that area on bike or – walking or using mass transit, so they also have been helping us.
Uh-huh. I'd like to mention, too, quickly, we're fortunate to have a nationally renowned expert on urban sprawl coming to Bloomington next week. His name is Dom Nazzi, and he'll be speaking at the City Council Chambers on Monday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. And I'd like to invite you, Mr. Mayor, and anyone else who's concerned about our quality of life in Bloomington to attend this event.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much for the very thoughtful call.
Okay, thank you.
We have just about 5 more minutes of the mayor's time here on the show. Let's get to some of these emails that we've got here also on infrastructure issues, although a little bit smaller scale, if you can hear the hinges creaking on that transition.
It worked.
All right. Here's an email also from a gentleman named Steve. Mr. Mayor, what proactive measures will the city take to get more downtown sidewalks shoveled – I assume that means coming into the winter months – so that I may continue to walk to work instead of drive?
That has been an ongoing issue. We have started programs where we have asked different – we've tried to do as much as we can in terms of education and public awareness on this issue. And unfortunately, in some instances, usually a rare instance, we also are having to turn more to enforcement. Sometimes it's a confusion as to whether the owner of the building or whether the owner of the particular shop or whether it's the landlord or whether it's the tenant who's responsible. And we try to make that very clear both to tenants and building owners so that there is no question there. We're also we've hired a downtown specialist who you'll start to see and some more equipment being put into maintaining the downtown sidewalks and literally have what I would almost refer to as a miniature plow of our own to try to go through and make sure that's done. If there are particular problem areas as you see it as they come up with the weather, it is great if you'd give us a call and let us know about it. We do go out. We do try to work amicably with everyone and take it from a public awareness and education approach first, but ultimately we are willing to use enforcement mechanisms if we have to. It is a real issue.
Will that plow be affixed to that nifty new electric vehicle that I'm not sure if we – have we purchased that?
The GEM is on its way to being purchased, and I don't know. We actually have a little bit, I think, stronger and a little bit smaller vehicles that will be able to help to help the plowing.
Here's an email that I think might be expressing some frustration pertaining to some construction on Walnut Street. What can be done to ease traffic through the downtown area of Walnut Street? Can we have delivery trucks park and unload on one side only? Will you address the traffic problem in Bloomington in your next term as mayor?
The loading and unloading issue, there are specific laws, and for the most part, I would say that those trucks that that you see are following them, and it's in their best interest to follow them because they're trying to get to one delivery after another as fast as they can. It is the parking on two sides of the street that's been a problem. I have to say that I've not been a big advocate for requiring – and I'm open to the idea, but I want to try to put out another side of the coin here. That is, if we do require the trucks to park just on one side and their delivery destination is on the other side of the street, they then are having to navigate across traffic or down – and obviously they can go down to a crosswalk, but sometimes it's mid-block. That means their truck will probably stay blocking traffic on that one side even longer. Other cities have handled it different ways. Some cities ban it altogether, and you have to use side streets. I will say that there's when I go and see the truck delivery, I see twofold issue. One is the problem that this caller or this email author is noting. The other is this is a sign that the economy is strong in these downtown businesses. This is their lifeblood or those deliveries. And I'm happy to see that. So it's looking for balance. And yes, we are continuing to do that, and also to start to look at better pedestrian crosswalks, bicycle lanes to keep people safer.
Mayor Crizan, we were talking before the show that there's a historical lull in city government activity around between the passage of the budget and then Election Day, which we'll remind everyone is November 6th. Although absentee voting in person at the Currier Building is going on right now. But one of the things that's going to make that a little bit more exciting is that we do have a visit from quite a significant foreign dignitary coming our way. What is the city doing to prepare for the coming of the Dalai Lama?
Sure. Well, we're working with the university, the State Department, which is a little bit different for us, and most especially with the Tibetan Culture Center, and view this as a cultural experience for the city, certainly a huge tourism aspect to it. All the people who will be visiting, thousands of people who will be visiting the community. And then, and this is key to me, is these are people who then enjoy that experience, go back home, either revisit the city or word of mouth and others follow. It's the same kind of effect that we have from Lotus Festival. It's the same kind of effect we have from really one of our biggest economic developers in the community is the IU Athletics Department. And of course, this is homecoming weekend, and we encourage people to participate in all those festivities and most directly in going to the game itself. It's people who come to town for all these different variety of reasons, go back to their homes, and I'm amazed at the number of people who want to move here based on having experienced it or certainly want to come back and visit or encourage their friends to do so. The Dalai Lama's visit is a huge opportunity. It's another reason Bloomington's on the map.
I think it's a terrific note on which to leave it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for
thank
taking
you
the time,
very
as
much.
Always, to come in and speak with us. This has been Ask the Mayor with Bloomington Mayor Mark Crizan. I'm Adam Ragusa. Join us again next Wednesday. That's the 24th. Kokomo Mayor Matt McKillop will be our guest. For producer Colin Bishop and engineer Mike Paskash, thank you as always for listening.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286 horsepower TL Type S with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.